grab your highlighters. Can't find them? They're probably right there in your pocket protector. It's time for that Early Childhood Nerd Podcast. Let's get nerdy. Here's Heather.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd. I'm Heather Burnt Santee, and he is Mike Huber. Hi, Mike.
Hey.
We're going to do another episode where Mike has an idea he wants to talk through, so we're just going to record it and let everybody listen as we work through this idea. So let me jump in and just do this quote, and then Mike, I'll let you start with it, okay?
Okay.
This is from Peter Gray. He has a Substack, if folks aren't aware of that. And this one comes from a post he wrote called "What Exactly is Play?" And he says, "The rules of play provide boundaries within which the actions must occur, but they do not precisely dictate the actions. The rules always leave plenty of room for creativity. Activities that are precisely prescribed by rules are better referred to as rituals than as play. Play is always creative."
All right.
Sorry for stumbling through that. I haven't really talked much yet since I woke up.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. That's the hard part of recording early.
Other people have probably been up for 5 hours. It's like 10 o'clock. Anyway.
Well, and when they listen to this, who knows what time it is?
Exactly.
Anyways.
What?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot because I think what I'm writing about right now is pretend play for kids, which is very rule bound and yet also really whatever expansive, you know, that idea that whatever you can be this, it can start with, you know, your Rainbow Bright and Rainbow Dash. Man, going to the wrong.
I was like, do people still play Rainbow?
No,
right?
Sorry. That was a, my age.
Yeah.
Rainbow Dash, and you're like, whatever, pretending to fly fast, and suddenly you decide that you're a dragon because you want to be more powerful or, you know, whatever it is, you like, the play keeps changing often, especially as children get a little older and more practiced at pretend play. But I would argue even the most basic pretend play as well, but you slowly like change, and yet you're still following these boundaries. It's just you might change where the boundaries are, and that's play versus if you think about what I guess Peter Gray is calling rituals of, I mean, even simply like sports, you know, when you watch kids play sports, it's like you are doing something within these rules that everybody is following,
and it's a problem if you don't.
And it's a problem if you don't. Yeah. And, you know, people who play sports choose to do that for that reason. And if anything, they get upset if somebody else doesn't follow the rules. And, you know, they might push the envelope with that. But then when they get called on it, they are called on it, you know. Yeah. But with play, it's different. Like if a child jumped right from Rainbow Dash and then started like, you know, the other kids were also My Little Ponies. And then they suddenly started shooting.
Yeah. You know,
whatever rarity or something like that would not fly, right? That doesn't fit the boundaries, but boundaries I like because it's this idea that it can keep changing as you play. I mean, so if I was doing a sports metaphor, I might think of like playing catch with a frisbee, and you start where you're each in one spot and you're trying to throw it roughly to the person, and maybe you're not a good throw, or you know, it goes differently, so the person has to run over, but no one thinks you're like breaking the rules.
Right.
And you might slowly either, like my brother and I, because we both talk a lot, we'd get closer and closer till the end we're about 2 feet away and just talking. Or you might like expand out farther, like you realize, you know, everyone's skill is whatever, or there's a tree that keeps getting in the way.
Yeah.
Or whatever, and you just keep moving versus you know, ultimate frisbee where there's very specific rules. And so I think thinking about that with children, there's a lot going on with them following these self-imposed rules. And I would also say group-imposed rules, because sometimes there is a child who's maybe doesn't know the storyline.
Yeah.
You know, maybe sees someone's toy My Little Pony but has no idea about anything else. And actually with a lot of 3 and 4 year olds, it's just the color of the ponies and the names. It has nothing to do with the personalities of the ponies. I don't know why we're going with ponies today, but
I don't know. Mike woke up with My Little Pony today. So I think this is really an interesting way to think about power that I'd thought about this rules within play before, but not necessarily in context of power, because for one thing, there's a couple of different spots developmentally, theoretically, where we start to talk about children understanding games with rules or wanting to do play with rules. And we interpret that as adults often as, we can start sitting down and doing like board games, or we play these where the adult tells the child the rules and now they're ready for rules.
Yeah.
But what you're describing is the children having the power to use their own creative thoughts or impulses to decide how the play is going to happen. So even if it's just that very familiar family pretend in the kitchen area, there's still rules about, you know, there's the assigning of the roles or the assumption of the roles, and that's part of it. But then, like, okay, so you're the cat, the rule says then that the cat says meow and is down on, you know, crawling. You can't be walking and talking to me and be the cat.
Yeah, you're not sitting at the table.
Yeah, a really interesting way to think about, because I think a lot about how we withhold power from children and choice all day. You look at a typical schedule. I do this with students a lot. Look at a typical schedule and tell me how often the child really gets to decide what happens to them, for them, whatever. And this is a really easy way to give some of that power. It's much more authentic than the, do you want the blue cup or the red cup?
Right.
It's allowing them the time and the space to play where this kind of stuff will just
emerge. And I think people who talk about why you would schedule things so much or decide so many things for children would say, well, we're preparing them because in kindergarten or in first grade, they're going to have to follow the schedule.
Yeah.
And to me, what it's ignoring is, well, before a child can follow an imposed schedule, they have to learn how to, you know, the basic executive function skills. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to, one, mentally picture what the whole day looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, okay, I can't do this right now, but I will be able to, you know, so thinking of a third grader, I can't talk to my friend right now, even though they're sitting next to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can picture in my head that when we go to lunch, we're going to sit next to each other. So then following that, like controlling the impulse of wanting to talk right now, they have that ability because they also have worked on their working memory and their mental flexibility of being able to, okay, I can't do it now, but I can do it later. Therefore, I can control my impulse.
Right.
And I think a lot of adults have the opinion, no, you just force children to do things at a younger age and they will be able to do them. Yeah. And that's only true, again, going back to like, it's only true if you kind of like, in a sense, break the child, right? Mm-hmm. Don't think any thoughts on your own. Be afraid of my wrath.
Yeah.
And we might not want to say it that way, but that is exactly what we're doing. Even if the wrath is whatever, I'm going to make you go sit away from your friend.
Or, oh, this makes me so sad when you
playing on emotional
it's
not,
you know,
lying to kids.
There's maybe a food shortage coming, so let's stop giving children food now.
Their bodies are gonna have to do it
instead
but
of
it's
thinking,
even more
let's
than
give
that
them all the things we need as much as we can now to make sure that they're like the healthiest they can be when that.
Well, and I would even say in this metaphor, it's probably even more like, let's learn how to garden.
Yeah.
Like, let's learn what we could plant indoors in pots and maybe grow so we can have something to eat, right? Yeah. Because the idea of working on basic executive function skills around following your internal, you know, your self-imposed rules or boundaries, I think is a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And then following that, you know, so like right now, oh, I switched from being, going back to the original thing, I switched from Rainbow Dash to a dragon, but they both fly. So I kept some part of that, but also changed it because I want to be scary too. Or whatever. And, you know, maybe the game itself, maybe somebody else turned into something first, or someone, you know, but it's that idea that you're keeping some of a bit, you know, you're being mentally flexible. Mm-hmm. And right now it's just in the moment, and it's in your, the things you can picture in your mind. But that, I mean, oh, so now I'm still getting future, like focusing on the future. Uh-huh. But if people are worried about that,
yeah,
stepping back and allowing the play, children develop the basic skills. And I guess I would argue, so, you know, forget about being prepared for school. It could mm-hmm. be that you really want to hang out with your friend and they're sick or whatever. So dealing with frustration in life, mm-hmm. That it starts with being able to create boundaries yourself, change them as needed. And frankly, that's another skill that I think our schools fail at almost every age level, mm-hmm. is if you're like doing something and it's not quite right for you, you should be able to alter it. What would make sense? Mm-hmm. Even if you're talking about some graduation standard for high school or to get your PhD, like what is the thing that's not fitting? And how do you adapt that to actually make the, you know, achieve the goal you set for yourself? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So even when it gets as more of an adult idea of goals that you set and achieve, it still requires the same, originally that same setting of boundaries and then possibly changing them as you go. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely where I've been reading a lot more of, Bandura's theory of agency, where he talks about you project yourself into the future, then you have the agency, so you might break down skills into thing or not agency, self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. So you believe that you can do it, and you're going to do that by breaking it down to smaller skills. You're going to look at people who've already done it or already done these parts of it, even if you're doing something past that. Mm-hmm. And then you need that self-regulation to not get too frustrated from it, mm-hmm. or whatever. And that sense of agency is something that allows us to have hope, you know, whether it's having an illness and just knowing here's the things I have to do now. It's mm-hmm. hard to imagine I'm going to be there, but I also have to in some ways mm-hmm. know where I want to get to so I can break down this is what I need to do this week or yeah. today. And sometimes, you know, the self-regulation is the, as much as I need to worry about all the different steps right now, I'm going to try to focus on this, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and then having other people around creates some of that.
Yeah. And so this is, for some people, I think this is a different way of thinking about self-regulation, what you're talking yes. about, because so often what I hear and even what I see like in early learning standards,
yeah.
when they're talking about self-regulation, they're really talking about being able to comply, being able
yes,
to.
Yes, that's true. The ultimate goal is to comply.
Is compliance. And so we want students or children who can, So I'll say squish down their yeah. own feelings and frustrations right. and needs to serve the group or to serve the leader.
Yeah.
And that's not what you're describing when you're right, talking right. about self-regulation here.
Yeah. And I do think that it, you know, unfortunately still goes back to behaviorism, mm-hmm. Right? That Bandura very consciously, when he was starting his work, I listened to a podcast recently where he talked about like, he was going against behaviorism, and his whole idea was how can he show that? No, you get to decide how to change. You don't need people to like use these behaviorist methods to change you. You need to do it. And what I like about the theory is it still shows where you might need support. But you know, the support might be the person needs someone to co-regulate with them, mm-hmm. and reminder that everybody needs that. That is why we have friends or spouses and, you know, we turn to other people when we are at our most mm-hmm. emotionally vulnerable. Mm-hmm. That's co-regulation. It's not just a thing that's like a weakness or like a deficit. It's right. a thing that we all need mm-hmm. at times in our life. And then when we don't have it in person, we have to imagine those people, you know what I mean? Getting a card from someone, or even just picturing, oh, I can't wait to see them again. You know, I'm going to survive this to get to see them, or whatever. I'm going to like
harder dark
truths. I know. But even if you look at it as the positive, like, oh, I can't wait to celebrate, you know, getting this, you know, doctorate with these people. I mean, it's generally not the reason you're doing the doctorate, but also,
why not?
Well, you still want to celebrate with them. You're still going to plan the party or know someone is planning it for you.
Yeah. So as you were talking earlier and you talked about self-efficacy, I think we can also pull in here when we're thinking about rules and play, and we can pull in, maybe we can pull it in, internal and external locus of control into the conversation.
For sure. Yeah.
Because we know that we should know that, or it's out there for us to find that, that's a big impact, a big factor impacting mental health.
Right.
And we are talking a lot, we're marketing things a lot. We're doing lots of webinars and things about mental health and early childhood. When we're also then giving them programs where they spend their days with almost completely that external locus of control. Someone else determines all day. Yep. And maybe I'm just restating what we've already said, but using different words. But I can't impact anything to change. And that, that idea, that constant experience of, I don't have the power to change the thing that's hurting me or bothering me, or I'm not comfortable with, or it just isn't good for me, is something we have to take seriously in our programs with young children.
For sure. And it makes me think in a way, as you say that, right, that so part of it is, children need a sense of agency, sense of power. Teachers need a sense of agency, sense of power.
Sure,
providers of any sort. And yet these like social emotional learning, I think it was an episode we never actually recorded, but you know, but now I can't remember the exact essay that we were going to record about, but it was basically an article arguing against social emotional learning curriculum.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it is.
It was the curmudgeon that. Anyway, it's a blogger, an education blogger, something about a curmudgeon. And he's
I think that's what it gets at, you know, is that like, oh, if you take this boxed curriculum of, oh, here's, this is what it looks like to be sad. This is what it looks like to be happy. When you're sad, these are the things you do or whatever, you know, that all those curricula, like kind of do the same basic thing. And it, children do need to learn words for their emotions, but getting through it is experiencing the emotions in some form. You know, that you're creating the basic idea that I can be sad, I can lose something and mourn the loss of my favorite blanket, grieve, and then find a way to deal with it, because you're creating that basic schema around loss that later when something bigger happens, you at least have something to hang that framework on.
Right.
It's going to be a lot harder than when it turns out to be your pet. And then it's going to be even harder when it turns out to be a family member. And, and you know, of course, not everyone has the luxury of those things going in that order.
In that order.
But the more you have something, that schema, that framework to hang the heavier things on, the more likely you are to get through it.
Right.
With, I don't know what the right word would be, in a healthy way.
Yeah.
You know, that you're all going to experience, but you might need more help or more time than you would have had you been able to experience these things lighter. And the same is true of any, even the, whatever you want to call it, more, the more, I don't know, positive emotions or whatever word you want to use, like being happy also.
Right.
Like, how can you be happy without also like shaking your whole body so much you're actually knocking down your, you know, classmates building or something, you know, like you can have these controls around it, but it's the thing you have to experience. You have to have interactions with other people, peers, as well as adults when you're a young child, and no boxed curriculum, nothing on Pinterest or whatever is going to help you with that.
Right.
You might find a little thing of like how to, like, because I do think that, like, just emotions, vocabulary around emotions, it has to start with happy and sad and scared and mad.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think if we're not sharing more nuanced vocabulary with 4 and 5 year olds, we're doing a disservice.
Absolutely.
That there's a difference between being frustrated and irritated and furious, and you need to have the language around that, because if all you have is you're either happy or mad, you know, I can think of so many, and I know this is simplifying it, but so many, you know, young men who commit acts of violence because somebody rejected them for something of like, oh, you needed that. You needed someone to walk through those emotions when you were 3.
Yeah.
Something happened that you didn't like and didn't just get told, well, use your words.
Right.
Because, you know, the person didn't think that it was their job to give you words.
Right. Right.
Or to,
yes.
Or even to empathize with you first. Right.
Yes.
Or they were emotionally manipulating you, saying that makes me sad when you.
Exactly.
When,
yeah. You know, or they were giving you false information about what you were feeling.
Right. And I don't want to like
doing
one of those things once in a while because you're still trying to get rid of those habits isn't what I'm saying. But if we think that that's the way we're going to work with kids, and then, you know, elementary school gets even harder with, well, social emotional learning is the thing we do Friday afternoon.
Right.
And then
if you
it's
were
like
in it.
If you were. As opposed to, oh, something happened and this child's really frustrated and
Let's
we're not helping them through
here.
Those emotions. And then we're going to leave it to the social worker who has 400 cases. You know, like the system, if we don't actually focus, if we don't actually we don't take mental health seriously. If what we think we need to do is give children a few hours of this or that.
Or if we think that all we need to do is have some mindfulness in our circle time.
Right.
You know, those aren't necessarily the worst things that you could do with children, but it's not enough. And it's not
the end.
The
point,
kind
yeah.
of authentic experience that's really going to lead to that kind of social and emotional literacy.
Right.
That we hope to have.
Here's what I'll say specifically. If you are doing some sort of breathing technique during your, you know, circle time or whatever, then when the child is upset and you have, and you do that same thing with them, they are more likely to do it. If you haven't practiced it when you're calm, you can't suddenly learn to do a breathing technique while you're upset.
Yeah.
So that's
seems punitive. If
and
you wait until
they're
already upset or have done the thing you don't want them to do.
Right. So it's not saying you don't do that moment
at
circle time, but it's only social emotional learning. It's only something that they're actually going to take with them if it's also applied.
Right.
Without the application, it's something that won't stick with you.
Right. Yeah.
Just like learning letter of the week when it's not, it's something that's not applied.
Yep.
And therefore, you know, in 4 weeks, it's gone.
It's gone. Yeah. Curmudgication is the name of the blog I couldn't think of. If anyone's really dying to go look, I think he had a post. It was like, why I don't teach SEL or I don't teach.
And it was a while ago. And
it was a while
ago. Now we can pretend that we actually did the episode.
Check it off our list. So I want to go back to play here for a minute because I feel like is like the ultimate, like so many other things, the ultimate place for children to play with those kinds of emotions or the emotion language and those powerful big feelings in a place that they have some control, but also we're there. Like, you know, for that person who's like, well, when they're playing, I don't feel like I'm a teacher or whatever. I don't know what to do. Well, what's my role? Well, that's one of them, is to kind of be there as they're working through in pretend or in real conflict that comes up as they're negotiating rules and figuring out power between. That's a big important thing for us to be prepared to.
For sure. And that pretend play is that opportunity to try out those emotions and kind of play with, this is how I do it. You know, so it's almost that schema of like, oh yes, this is a thing that's very scary, but I'm so powerful, I will deal with it. Or this is a sad thing, like, oh, I definitely have the kids to play sad play too. And I want to quote, so Kylie Cooper, who I work with, she had written her master's on like fear play, the way children play with fear. And this is good. It is kind of a quote because it's going to be in my book. Like, it's, all right. I already was like, oh, that's how this chapter's ending. Yeah. And we'll see, you know, it's first draft, so it might change. But she talked about the way pretend play does this is because children can, if it becomes overwhelming, they can just step out of the role.
Right. Yeah.
But also they can really feel it. And children really do have this ability to get into that flow state where they are reacting in the emotions of the character they've taken on. And then if it gets overwhelming, they can step out of it. But in the meantime, they are experiencing a lot of, you know, like their heart rate actually will go up. Or I actually did that once where I had kids wearing the, you know, the bracelet and it was amazing. Like that's during pretend play, it's like, oh, they really seem to be experiencing these emotions, you know? But she said that all this play comes to a child being able to figure out, how do you find your way to safety? How do you find your way to consent? How do you find your way to acceptance? And even though it's pretend and they're doing it and they don't need to do it with you, you being there helps them get to that point if they don't do it on their own. Because if they're playing, you know, especially a more socially, so more typical like four-year-olds or, or whatever, where five kids are playing and suddenly three are dragons, but two of them still just want to, you know, be My Little Ponies. And suddenly the safety thing doesn't feel right because these other kids are pretending to breathe fire on me. And even though it's pretend and it's in this realm of, you know, pretend, the child can still experience it to a certain degree. I'm not saying that they actually are worried that they will get burned, but they will experience the thing of a person overpowering them. Right. And so that's, you know, stepping in and like, oh, you know, what's going on here? It looks like we have, you know, different ideas about play. And you being there to be able to do that, even if you don't have to do that, the fact that children know you are there to do that, if it gets to that point, allows them to push these boundaries and decide that we're going to change. We're going to go into this way that might be a little more scary, but I know that this adult is there to take care of me. Right. So that's where pretend can really, allow children, like, you have a huge role in it, even if the role is simply to be there. And then meanwhile, all those things the children are doing around whatever you want to call it, regulation, regulating their own emotions around things that can be scary or around things that can be happy too, of course. Again, same thing, like whatever they're playing, they can try these things out in ways that are rule bound from their perspective, and they can alter that or step out of the role whenever they want.
So it's, I'm thinking about the conditions of play now and how, you know, how this all fits, but you know, one of the things we know that makes play the way children learn best, one of the reasons why we know that happens is that it's relevant to them. So they're going to spend more time with it. They're going to stick with it longer, even when it gets a little weird for them. They're going to, you know, they just have that drive to remain involved and see what happens. And I think that when you combine that with this idea of power and emotional development and and executive function, like that's why this kind of play is so much more effective if our end goal is this, you know, this regulated human being. Because they're going to stick through it more than if we're trying to,
because it's self-chosen.
It's self-chosen and it's bringing them some sort of joy. Even if it doesn't look like happy joy, you know, just that, that keeps the brain engaged. And, you know, that's just, we can still do the, you know, if we have the curriculum that tells us we need to read the emotion book or look at the emotion flashcards or whatever, that's how we connect our goal to their goal. With them still being sort of in control of the context of that.
Yeah. And, you know, information is important and vocabulary is one that only comes from people who are more experienced, whether it's adults or older children. And regardless,
so we should also be modeling and using domain, our own emotional language and being authentic in our tone and all that kind of
and
stuff.
And reading storybooks that are engaging, that do involve emotions, rather than reading books about, just reading books about emotions, right? That having a storyline where a child does get frustrated or character gets frustrated is going to be way more effective than getting, you know, this book that talks about frustrated means, you know. And there's some, if you're, it's okay to do both, especially if one has like a lot of words. But if you don't also put in the context of a story, or then it's like I can see a child going to do pretend play and very much kind of doing this, trying out these different things. And children can try out much more complex things in pretend play than they can in real life, you know. And I know sometimes people think, oh, but stuff like, you know, playing like Luke and Darth Vader, there's good guy and bad guy. And yet I've watched 5-year-olds kind of play with the, you know, that line, Luke, I'm your father, or whatever. And they usually have it simplified, but, you know, they've, I know the kids I'm thinking of, they learned it from Legos. Actually, one of the kids, I learned that their bedtime stories from dad were stories about the characters from the first three movies. So that sort of mythology, but it's based on these characters. But those ideas of like this idea of like, wait, it's father and son, and yet also they're in a battle to the death. And a 5-year-old can hold both those things at once when it's in this context of a story, and they're embodying that story. And again, this is self-chosen play. Not all 5-year-olds are ready to learn about a father and son battling to the death, right? And that's, and which is fine. And that's why allowing kids to do this in their pretend play, they are self-choosing based on what they know. And they kind of ignore the stuff they don't know. Most kids I've seen play Star Wars over the years, it really is stormtroopers bad, you know, Princess Leia good, or
lightsabers are fun.
And lightsabers are fun. And that's the other part of it, that joy of just the physical movement and contact, you know, the rough and tumble play that happens in there, the roughhousing, especially where kids are knocking each other over. What that does in a very physical sense is, you are now having to figure out how to counteract what, because your goal was to stay up and hit the person with your lightsaber or your pool noodle or whatever. And now you're being knocked over. So now physically you are trying to, how do I still, you know, hit this other person with my lightsaber when I'm no longer standing? And so you're constantly, when you think about the mental flexibility to do that, especially while you're dealing with sensory input that's changing constantly, there's so much going on there, right? You know, and if you're not ready for it, what you do is you just fall down, which, you know, is fine in the context of the game. Most children are motivated to keep the game going, so the other child doesn't then take advantage of you being down, unless you have that trust to, oh, I'm going to keep doing this because, you know, they think it's fun.
Right.
If they don't, they're going to say stop or whatever, you know, but you only do that when you have the trust to do that sort of thing. When you don't have the trust, usually the game is chase. You don't, there's some basic rules and you just follow
it. Game of chase.
And then you can add little pretend elements to it. I'm a bear and I'm chasing you. Now I'm a whatever, you know, stormtrooper and I'm chasing you. Whatever the thing is, you're still just playing chase. And there's no difference in the... from the outside world, there's no difference. In the internal minds of the children, there might be a difference. And I do think that that's the other thing to keep in mind with all of this, is that you can't fully understand play by watching from the outside. And it's okay as long as you remember that. Right. And that...
I want you to explain that more.
So I'm definitely influenced by phenomenology in this point. And I was interested to see, I didn't read the full quote, but that Peter Gray is also talking about it, right? And so the idea of phenomenology is that you can't understand anything without being part of it, right? So in some ways, this really influenced, you know, anthropology, for one, right? Uh-huh. Of like just going and looking at the people, oh, they do these weird things. Here's the weird things they do.
Yeah.
Versus, I'm going to go live with these people for 6 months. And like, oh, that's why they always spit out the first bite of food or uh-huh. whatever the thing uh-huh. is, right? You start to understand the context to a certain degree. Obviously, there's limits to that,
yeah.
you know, because yeah. you have your own experience before that. But at the same time, you do have more of an understanding. And I think the same is true of play, mm-hmm. that when I used to ban gunplay, for instance,
yeah.
I was looking at it and saying, this looks too much like out there. You know, I was in a neighborhood that did have mm-hmm. violence from firearms. And I was like, therefore, we don't do it here because it looks too much like that. Then when I started to allow it and seeing the way kids were getting this sense of power from it, like they were feeling more empowered.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, you know, sometimes the play would be things like, well, bullets can't hurt me, I'm powerful. Mm-hmm. And as I watched them do it, I started to understand they don't actually believe that they literally can go out if there was, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever, someone had pulled out a handgun on their block, that they would run out there and say, I can't be
right.
In the same way that when they were playing the game and they were like running and they saw somebody else like drawing a picture, they avoided that person. They could see the real world
mm-hmm.
and still be in this pretend play. So the more I kind of tried to follow along, the more I started to understand, oh, they're actually getting this sense of power from this
mm-hmm.
in a place that can feel, you can feel powerless.
Sure.
Like you can have this fear of getting shot. And now it's like, oh, actually there's this sense of power. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take away from any, you know, real life, what you might need to do.
Right.
To follow that, but you still need that internal, like feeling that self-efficacy that you can survive this. Mm-hmm. Right. So again, if it helps, thinking of, I think why I bring up adult examples is it's yeah. a little easier for people to get into that mindset, to be part of it.
Right.
And so all I'm trying to say is that like with play, you're not going to fully understand if you don't follow it. It's like every book I've read with in early childhood talks about when they're describing kids playing, they always talk about the kids, use their names, you know, talk about what they're doing as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book I'm working on now, I try to write, if the child is in character, I'm only writing about, you know, Bumblebee is doing this,
oh,
right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, not, you know, Eric pretending yeah. to be Bumblebee is doing this. Because I think that then I lose too much of what are they doing? He's yeah. trying, you know, Bumblebee is trying to get away from Omega Supreme.
Oh, that's a good, yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. And it shifts, you know, and I see the thing, the person the writer I've seen do it the most is Elizabeth Jones. Mm. But what she would do is try to be playful in the beginning and endings of the chapter, like, but
mm-hmm.
pulling you in as the reader of like, oh yeah, I have to be playful to understand this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been amazing even writing it that I keep going, like I'll find myself drifting back to talking about the child. It's like, mm-hmm. wait a minute, they haven't stepped out of character. I have to stay in the character.
Uh-huh.
And it's really hard for my brain, but I do feel like even that little exercise helps me see, well, what are they trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what is their experience? Like, oh yeah, it's really exciting to be chased.
Right.
When you're in the right mood.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a different perspective than like me saying, well, here's the reasons I academically know that children engage in power play. So right. when I see the power play, I assume that they are doing these things
right.
instead of saying, looking at the character that's being played and thinking of it in terms of the things, the actions, the words that the character is putting out there.
Right, right.
Changes.
Yeah.
I would learn more deeply about what was happening than if I just said, here are my labels.
Right.
I'm going to throw them on here because it yeah. looks like.
A friend of mine simplified it to when you're looking at a cube, all you see is a square. Right. And that's all you're going to describe. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, if you just describe what they're doing social emotionally,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
it's this. Or you could view it as this is what they're learning with literacy because they're sure. using, you know, because
which I think
play
is a starting point. Right.
And I it's mean, okay.
I think
right. Yeah.
There's something to that.
For
I
sure.
do that a lot. But to go deeper.
Yeah, and to be aware of it at some point, you want to be aware that, oh, I am only looking at this part right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, even what we were doing, some of it I was. Mm-hmm. But then when you try to go into the cube in this example, and suddenly it's like, oh, there, I could also look at it this way. Or like, oh, the emotions running through it. No wonder, like, I think of my, I cringe at this, but my first year of teaching.
Yeah.
And the kids wanted to play superhero. And I felt out of control. You know, uh-huh. I'm not controlling the classroom. So it was like, let's be real superheroes. Let's be firefighters.
Yeah, that's the way it always goes, right? Yeah.
And nobody wanted to play firefighter. I mean, once in a while, kids do. I don't mean to discount it, but, you know.
But it's not the same need.
It's not the same need. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, I do hear from my brother's friends with a firefighter. I guess I know one firefighter. And, like, they often talk about wanting to help people. And, oh, yeah, even when I was pretending, I was always helping people.
Oh, yeah.
I played, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. So people who are now adults, like, I played Superman or I played. And it's like, oh, you played the superhero.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to help people. And that was, like, a really, like, engaged way to do it. You felt, like, all your emotions around it. And I'm thinking people playing, you know, firefighter. Okay, well, they're first responders. And right now they're checking the person's pulse. And they're like, mm-hmm. you know, oh, they're getting the AKG ready, you know.
Yeah.
Like, no, that's not what kids play. They're like these, they're hanging from a cliff. And I'm going to do, you know. And so it just, when you go inside it, then you aren't going to suggest something like, oh, mm-hmm. let's not play, I don't even know what the latest superheroes are.
No, me neither. But, I mean, I had a classroom and it was twos, but there were a couple of boys who were like three and waiting for space to move up. And they were much bigger than everybody else. And it was a small room because you need less square footage in a licensed toddler room than, it, you know, just all these factors. And they were playing Spider-Man, essentially. And it, all it really meant was run and climb and chase. And but using Spider-Man language and or vocabulary. The director and another teacher were really upset about that and wanting to stop it. And so their idea was, well, we'll do like a visit. We'll have some firefighters come in.
Yes. Right.
But,
right.
But then when they did, the children sat and listened while the firefighters talked.
Right. Right.
And when we really got down to it, the need was the movement, the freedom, the power.
Right.
They were in a space that was too small for them. They were being seen as problems when they were just doing 3-year-old things.
Yep.
And it had really very little to do with Spider-Man making them that way.
Yeah. I worked at the first place I worked at was really close to a hospital that had like the helicopters would land on the roof, you know, and so the kids would like, when we were outside, they'd like be pointing at the helicopter, all excited. And so then one of the teachers arranged like us going to visit the airport where the helicopters come from. And we went and we, you know, talking and, you know, so we're mostly, you know, of course we can't go out close. I think we got to look at a helicopter. I don't even think we were allowed to go in. Uh-huh. I mean, certainly it wasn't on at all when we were doing it. But as we were leaving, the one kid was so upset. The kid who got so excited about seeing them we're not going to get to fly in it. You know? And it's like, of course that's the thing they want to do. Like hearing about it, like having to sit there and listen to a thing about it.
Yeah, it's not the same.
It's not the same at all. And I'd much rather have a kid pretend they're flying a helicopter and they're flying into tornadoes and they are crashing into mountains and they are, you know, all these things that they can pretend and make it exciting to them as they learn about helicopters. And I, you know, and if I think about it from their point of view, it's more the excitement about it. It's more, they know that it's there to help people and they are trying to help people, but, you know, little did they know there was a tornado or whatever.
Right. They can't
whatever
help
the
nature.
Things are, but it's these very like broad things that they're doing. And being inside it, even though, you know, again, I'm an adult, I'm not there now, but if I can go into my kid brain and watch it from their point of view, you know, afterwards, when I'm talking to them, it's like, oh, that was really difficult. I'm so glad you kept us all safe, right? Yeah. Like, so when kids are like, you know, I'm a guard. I remember kids playing like Christmas dinner. There's a bunch of kids who celebrated Christmas. They're pretending to have people come over. In one kid's role, they put on like a motorcycle helmet or something and they stood with a big, you know, block or something, like 12 feet away and they're on the guard.
Yeah. Thank goodness like we had a guard.
That, and yeah, and being able to see it from his point of view, well, thank you for keeping us all safe so we can enjoy our meal, right? Rather than, don't you want to go sit with everyone? Or, you know, like if I don't see it from within that perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's funny in some ways because pretend play is all about perspective taking.
Yeah.
And we as adults decide that we are going to. So, right, there's like the real world and then there's this mental imagery happening at the same time. So there's the things you can physically see and there's the mental imagery. And kids are seeing mental imagery and a little bit the other one. But then they the adults, if they don't, you know, take the same perspective, the perspective shifting, they're just looking at it as I'm a teacher watching these four-year-olds sitting at a table and one child is standing 10 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is to have him come over and sit down. If I go into it, what's going on? And so, you know, you don't have to join the play to go into it. It can be, let me sit back and figure out what are all the roles.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one I often help people as the baby step, right? What are the rules they're following? What are the boundaries they've created?
Yeah.
And if that makes you feel better, then you know, oh, instead of me giving these fake choices at other times to have them learn boundaries or learn self-regulation, I can watch all the self-regulation going on when they are, you know, whatever, pretending to shoot a tornado or guarding Christmas dinner. And like, oh, he knows that the guard, if you were technically guarding something, you're not going to sit at the table with your loaded gun.
Right.
You're going to be standing 12 feet away. Yeah. Like, you know, but, you know, just that idea of if you can take the perspective. But I just find it funny that it's the lack of the adults shifting perspective because they worry about the kids not being able to shift perspective. And that's actually what they're doing.
Right. Right. So, and what is a key part of self-regulation and social and emotional growth is perspective taking.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the mental imagery of
the mental imagery. Yeah. Yeah.
Like what could we do instead of what's happening right now and what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's funny to me, but I do think that's a key part of it. And for me, it was helpful to try to read some phenomenology, you know, just to like...
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my morning now, as soon as we're done recording.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. well, now I'm spacing on the actual name of the text, but Merleau-Ponty is the author I'm thinking of.
Okay.
And I do actually think that it was a huge influence on the Reggio Emilia approach.
Oh, really?
Or, okay. And maybe not his specific writing, but it's interesting that in 1948, 1949, all these different things in Europe seem to be resolving around the idea of taking a perspective of, you know, immersing yourself in another perspective, essentially, that you can't understand things. Merleau-Ponty talked a lot about just sensory. Like you only sense the world from your perspective and then to experience it, you're only experiencing it through your own senses. And, you know, so there's this thing that only can exist in the time and place that you are. And there's a lot of, you know, I can see, what's his name?
Malaguzzi.
Thank you. I always get the letters wrong. Malaguzzi, like thinking of like, oh, the image of the child, what can a child do? So now I'm shifting my perspective to the child.
Sure. That makes sense.
You know, and so it's this idea that, oh, we actually, when you start to take that image, then it's like, oh, the child can do all these things, you know? So, yeah, I'm not sure if they actually influence each other. It's interesting that it's happening almost at the same time.
Think about,
makes me think that they're all reading the same thing or just realize that war is the extreme opposite of that, especially what happened in Germany and France and Italy, you know, which is where I see these writings happening. Like, oh, when we really take our perspective and think this is what everyone needs, and therefore I'm going to enforce this in the most, you know, physical sense of enforcing it. I am going to kill as many people as I have to have this point of view. It makes sense that they're like, oh, actually, you know what? What if we tried to understand?
What if we did it differently this time?
What if we did it differently? And even if it's something we don't quite understand, we thought, you know what? They must come from a different experience than us. Yeah.
There you go.
So anyways.
Well, all right. We'll end with war. If that's what with you war. Want to yeah, do. That's right. We'll just end this, wrap this
we
one
went,
up.
Yeah. There yeah. we go. Started with Rainbow Dash, ended with war, which, you know.
All right. Always a party when Mike's here. No, this is really interesting. I'm excited about the book.
Yeah. And these are still like the half-baked thoughts because I'm in the middle of trying to make a coherent statement out of this, but they are the things that are floating around. So thank you.
No, thanks for sharing.
And thanks everyone for listening to me rant because maybe now some of these ideas will be in the book.
Now they have to buy the book to find out if what's in here is really in there. All right, we probably better just wrap this up now.
Yeah.
We're to the point where I just start rambling and forget how to end that episode. So thanks everybody for listening to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd.
Yeah.
And that's the show. Now go get your nerd on.
Has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.
Oh.